At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It's not like you can leave if you don't like it, right? The global economy is where we begin today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Tuesday, the 7th of January. Today, good as always to have you along, everybody. The theme of the day today, and a useful reminder, really, at the beginning of a new year already overflowing with non-economic news, is that this is a global economy. We got to live in it, companies got to do business in it, and countries got to deal with it. I mention it because the good people at the Commerce Department, the Census Bureau in particular, told us this morning that the trade deficit, that is the gap between what we bought from the rest of the world and what we sold to it, fell in November. And that, in fact, the trade gap is at its lowest level since October of 2016. Now, that will surely make the President of the United States happy. He mentions the trade gap a whole lot in the mistaken belief that a large trade deficit is a sign of economic weakness. It's not, because we get stuff in return for all the dollars that we send abroad. But as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, the trade gap can tell us some things about our place in this global economy.
The trade deficit, like all the best economic indicators, can be read differently depending on what you want it to say. Take today's numbers, for example. The trade deficit is narrowing. It's at a three-year low.
This could mean that consumers are finding products that are domestically made and buying those instead, which might be the kind of thing that President Trump would be aiming for with his tariff policies.
Lena Mosley teaches political economy at the University of North Carolina.
Or it could mean that U.S. consumers and firms are simply buying fewer things overall because maybe they worry the economy is weakening. So that might be seen as a negative.
The deficit is driven by us buying more stuff than we sell. When it comes to services, education, hospitality, tech support, we send out much more than we bring in. So it matters which specific sectors are driving the changing trade balance. Jennifer Hillman is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
In terms of U.S. oil exports are up, aircraft engines, autos, oil drilling equipment, so a number of significant increases to U.S. exports.
So there are lots of good insights into the economy there, but Hillman says when it comes to the headline number, take it with a grain of salt.
In my view, as a general rule, the trade deficits don't really make that much difference.
Hillman says it can be a good snapshot of global competitiveness, but isn't necessarily good or bad on its face. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This is a Global Economy Part 2 on the program today. Comes with the ticker symbol GM, down almost 2% today because General Motors told investors this morning that its sales in China fell hard last year, down 15%. That's on top of a 10% tumble in 2018. Ford's in trouble as well. Their third quarter sales down 30%. Not the direction you want to be going in the world's biggest market. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is on that one.
Partly, this is all no surprise. Car sales have been declining in China generally for 2 years now. the whole auto industry is hurting a bit in China.
David Whiston is an automotive equity analyst with Morningstar. China's economic growth has been slowing. Inflation and uncertainty have hit middle to low income consumers hard.
Also, the trade war with the U.S. isn't helping. The Chinese government did pull back a while ago on shadow lending industry.
Meaning financing to buy cars has fallen. But also, some of GM's problems and Ford's have been their own fault. Alex Potter is a senior research analyst with Piper Sandler.
Their key issue is the product portfolio has not been refreshed at the same pace that some of the rivals have.
So some Chinese are bored with older models, and some older models are being phased out due to new emissions standards. Ford's portfolio of cars is among the oldest in the industry, Potter says, and it was a latecomer to China to begin with.
Their brand isn't as well defined. They haven't sort of staked a claim to a certain segment of the auto market like some of those other brands have.
German car makers such as Volkswagen have a newer, fresher lineup, and their market share has grown. One thing GM has going for it is its luxury brands. China's wealthy aren't as affected by economic troubles. Sales of GM Cadillacs were up 3.9%, and the company says it's introducing some new models to boost sales. But the outlook for 2020 is still dim. The car market's expected to decline 2% this year. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
You know who had a whiz-bang day car-wise? Tesla. That's who. CEO Elon Musk did a weird little dance on stage in Shanghai as the first Chinese-made Model 3s were delivered to local customers over there. Tesla shares, TSLA, is the ticker, up almost 4% today. That makes it the most valuable American car company ever, more than $84 billion in market capitalization, bigger than Ford and GM were in their prime, not inflation-adjusted, we ought to say, on that number. Elsewhere in stocks, less good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A little bit less than a month ago, December the 13th, day 526 of the trade war, depending on where you're counting from, China and the United States announced that phase one trade deal. And that day on this program, I said this. And on Wall Street this Friday, the 13th, priced in is the phrase you're looking for here. Today's trade deal has been... Priced in is today's installment of our series, Kai Explains.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
You recently asked what's going on with this economy.
So how do these two concepts work together?
One might think on news of a rollback, however slight, in hundreds of billions of dollars of tariffs between the two biggest economies on the planet, one might think that news like that would bring the happy music. But both the Dow Industrials and the S&P 500 started and ended that December 13th basically where they were. So how come?
The general notion is that when the eventual outcome is obvious or easy to anticipate, then when it actually happens, the market doesn't react.
That's Avanidhar Subramanian, and he's a professor of finance out at UCLA.
The China tariff war has been going on for a while, so financial markets and analysts have had time to analyze the situation and, in some sense, assess what kind of progress we're making.
For the past year and a half, traders have been taking in every piece of news, every tweet, every indicator, information, and buying or selling based on what they thought was going to happen.
So they say, okay, well, eventually China's going to come to the table. And then when China does come to the table and they cut a deal, the market doesn't react because they already know.
And that deal, in other words, had already been priced in. But
when the eventual outcome is hard to anticipate and comes at a surprise, the market does react.
Like the Soleimani news last Friday.
What happened over the holiday break was, to some extent, a surprise. So it's not surprising that the financial markets are still trying to assess what the implications of this action are.
Things have calmed a bit now, but last Friday, the day the assassination news broke, the S&P had its biggest decline in a month because...
It's not that easy to assess the long-term consequence of such an action.
So to recap, if the future is reasonably predictable, the markets will be too. If not... Not.
You can think of the stock market as a giant voting machine where individuals, traders, can go and cast their votes for what the stock is worth.
Paul Flatterer is a professor of finance at Stanford's Graduate School of Business.
And at the end of the day, proverbially speaking, it turns out that the market will, in at least in a loose way, reflect the consensus opinion of all those that are voting in the market.
So the market's consensus opinion about where things are heading in the Middle East? Too soon to tell, really. You can tell us what you want explained at marketplace.org, or you can hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Kai Ryssdal, that is, because they make me spell this for you, KAIRYSSDAL. To those for whom 30,000 economists talking about their projects and papers sounds interesting, well, you're going to have to wait till next year. The American Economic Association's annual meeting wrapped up this past weekend, and while there were surely papers and presentations of note, the AEA meeting has been in the news the past couple of years for the ways in which the economics industry treats women and minorities. In a word, not well. But that is changing slowly. New York Times economics writer and a Friday regular for us as well, Gina Smilek, was at the conference this year. Gina, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
This is the second year in a row that inequality, last year was gender and this year was race to some degree, inequality has been front and center for the people running, in a way, this profession, right?
Yeah, and specifically, we should be clear, inequality within the field itself.
Right.
So I think the talk of inequities sort of economically has been something that's been really dominant as a conversation in economics for a while. But what we've really seen is some sort of self-reflection and sort of some questioning of, you know, why aren't we applying these principles that we talk about sort of to ourselves?
Yeah, it's a little bit ironic, actually. Ben Bernanke, the outgoing or just past president of the AEA, says they're making progress, maybe not in substance as much as he would like, but certainly in process. Talk to me about what's being done to alleviate some of these issues within the economics profession.
Right. So we had breakfast with Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen while we were out there, and at breakfast, they told us that, you know, they're trying to do a couple of things to get the processes in place for women and minorities to feel more comfortable in the field. One of those is dealing with sort of outright abuse and outright discrimination. And to do that, they've now hired a person, an ombudsman, who people can take complaints to. And they're also applying a code of conduct to the profession. So this code of conduct is new starting last year, but there are actually going to be repercussions if people have investigations brought against them. And so, you know, it's really a whole array of steps that they're taking to make sure that the profession is actually being held accountable and not just sort of, you know, saying in word that these things are not with keeping in of our sort of professional values.
I think we all understand the toxicity of these power dynamics in a workplace. Talk to me about how it applies in academic economics in particular when you got a bunch of old white guys who make all the decisions.
Yeah, so it is a really tough thing in academics in general and in academic economics in particular to sort of break into these departments as a younger woman. And part of the reason is that the older people who have tenure tend to be men. They tend to be leading these departments. And so if, as a woman, you make angry someone who is important to your tenure decision, it's not necessarily just at the university you are currently sitting at that you are going to face repercussions for that. You could really face censure across all of the universities you would potentially want to work for, you know, because these people are so networked in. And so it's made it really hard to break into those male-dominated industries and move up and feel that you had a voice that could be heard and sort of, you know, protections that should be afforded to you in a workplace.
One of the things I found really fascinating in this article that you helped write in the Times about the conference this year was this woman from the MacArthur Foundation talking about diversity. And she said, you know, it's not just bringing in people with darker skin tones who use the same models and the same formulas and get the same conclusions. It's people with different life experiences who are going to think about these things different ways and use different ways of analyzing the economic issue.
Right. Absolutely. And I think it's really interesting. You know, one person who I've talked to a lot who I think emphasizes this point and also is emblematic of it is Mary Daly, who's the San Francisco Fed president. Yeah. Now, Mary is white, but she is a woman and she is a lesbian. And beyond that, she was brought up in sort of a lower income household, and she dropped out of high school. She got a GED before eventually going back to college. And so she's just got this really different experience, and she absolutely brings that to bear in her work. You know, you can really see it sort of running through the theme of all of the research she's done. And, you know, this is something she and I have talked about extensively. It's also something she talks about a lot when she's out giving speeches. You know, this diversity of backgrounds and this diversity of opinions that result from those backgrounds is really important and enhances the field as a whole.
I'm making a note to myself to renew our call to Mary Daly at the San Francisco Fed. Gina Smilek at the New York Times talking about some of the changes perhaps happening in the economics profession. Gina, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
It was pandemonium in here. There were TV cameras and the mayor came.
When things get crazy at the neighborhood bookstore. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is down 119 today, 0.4%, 28,583 on the blue chips. NASDAQ off 2 points, basically flat, 9,068. S&P 500 down 9 points, 0.2%, 32,037 there. Another retailer is shuttering many of its brick-and-mortar stores. Pier 1 Import says it's closing about half its locations, about 450 of them on Wall Street today, down 8.5%. Boeing is recommending pilots undergo simulator training before its 737 MAX's return to service. That is a change from the company's earlier position. Boeing still, though, lifted 1% amid unconfirmed reports that Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway plans to buy into that company's stock. You're listening to Marketplace. Hello to 2020 and all the new Marketplace investors who joined us before the end of the decade. Thank you so much for being part of this community of donors who believe in the importance of trustworthy, independent news and information. It's your ongoing support that keeps us going strong and helps make people smarter everywhere. Thanks again and Happy New Year.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look. Payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace. This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Modern times have, of course, brought us modern communications tools. Maybe you spent your holiday break on a social media detox or cleaning out your email for the new year. But for all the conveniences, there is peril as well. The unintended inference, the indiscreet post, say no more. And thus, there is a need for modern rules of online communications etiquette. Victoria Turk supplies it. She's a writer for Wired UK and an Emily Post of sorts for the digital age in her new book called Kill Reply All, A Modern Guide to Online Etiquette. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Was there an incident or something that made you write this book? How did you come to want to do this?
There wasn't any specific incident, really, I suppose, but more just a kind of general observation of people's behavior online, including my own, because I feel like digital etiquette, and indeed maybe etiquette as a whole, is something that people think that everyone else just happens to know and that they don't. And I think that's what causes a lot of the anxiety around these things. If you think about email, email's been around for decades. Mm-hmm. And yet, even though everyone kind of knows how to use email in a technical sense, there are so many questions around, you know, what's the correct way to do it? How fast do I have to respond? How should I sign off? And I think, you know, just everyone thinks that everyone else got the memo and they were missed out.
So let's talk about how to sign off an email, because you have very firm views on this.
And
So elaborate, would you? Because I was horrified to discover that thanks is not really acceptable.
Thanks is, in my opinion, one of the worst.
Wow.
Yeah, no, I mean, basically, my kind of rule of thumb is to just go with best wishes. I know some people think that's boring. They think it doesn't really convey their personality. I mean, I think if you're relying on your email sign off to convey your personality, maybe you need to get a hobby. And I think that the problem with thanks in particular, or even worse, thanks in advance, it's just so presumptuous. You know, you get that sort of passive aggressive tone that often creeps into email where, you know, if you're thanking someone for something they haven't actually done yet, that can seem almost a bit like a threat. You know, like, thanks
right.
in advance.
Well, okay, point taken. Can we go to phone calls, please? And I know we're talking social media and digital media, but still a lot of people use the phone. You basically say never call. Never call, ever.
Now, that's not strictly true.
Well, I'm reading your flowchart. Should you make a phone? Speaking of which, these flowcharts are great in this thing. Should you make a phone call? Step one, are you dying? Yes. Okay, you may call. No, is someone else dying? And then it goes from there. I mean, don't make phone calls.
Okay, but that's an unscheduled phone call, okay? So there's that's a crucial distinction. I actually quite like phone calls. I know, you know, a lot of people in my generation do not. They find the phone scary. I think there's a lot of advantages to speaking to someone on the phone. But the problem is when you just call out of the blue and the other person isn't expecting it. I think that is quite rude because, you know, you're never going to get them at a good time. So I have nothing against phone calls as long as you schedule in advance or even just texting before, you know, 5 minutes before and say, hey, can I grab you on the phone? Is it a good time?
All right. Point taken. Fine. Let me ask another thing, though. And you have a section on emailing like a CEO, basically emailing like a boss, in which you say just bang it out, get it done and short and quick and call it a day. What's the merit of... And I apologize in advance for saying this to the woman who wrote the book on etiquette online, but disregarding all these rules in the name of just getting something done.
So, yeah, I think especially when it comes to email, I would say, you know, the best etiquette is respecting other people's time. So whereas in the past you might have thought of etiquette as, you know, writing kind of quite florid sentences and, oh, how are you? And thanks for your last letter and all that kind of extra stuff. I don't think you actually need fancy flourishes to exhibit good etiquette. In fact, often I think, you know, that's actually not showing the most regard for your reader. So I am very pro a sort of pragmatic style of etiquette, which recognizes the modern condition. Now, there is a limit. You know, you still have to say please and thank you. You still have to be kind. But you can do that whilst also getting to the point.
Technology writer and author of a book called Kill Reply All, Victoria Turk. Victoria, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
We've got that should you make a phone call flowchart that I mentioned and related should you send an email flowchart on our website. Another thing you can do while you're there, by the way, is let us know how you're doing on your New Year's resolutions, your financial ones in particular. Share them with us at marketplace.org and we will help you hold yourself accountable. Independent. Independent bookstores are arguably the most endangered of economic species. I mean, they were literally Amazon's first target. But while there are certainly fewer of them now than there were 10 or 20 years ago, the American Booksellers Association says we've got about 2,500 independent bookstores out there right now, and they are not only surviving, but some of them are thriving, as Minnesota Public Radio's Dan Crocker explains.
The seeds for the Zenith Bookstore, which opened in Duluth, Minnesota 2.5 years ago, were sown on the streets of Manhattan.
We used to love kind of walking the streets and visiting bookstores. That was kind of our, we're both big readers, and so that was one of our favorite activities.
Bob DeBrow is the bookstore's owner. He met his wife Angel in New York in the 1980s when the city was full of bookshops.
We lived in Manhattan. We were young and in love and full of energy, and we would walk for hours.
You know, one of the things you sort of casually say to each other is a fantasy. Is that wouldn't it be fun one day to open a bookstore?
The DeBrows got married, had kids. Bob became a math professor at Carleton College in southern Minnesota. When he retired a few years ago, they were packing up boxes of books when that crazy idea popped in their heads again.
It was literally like a bolt of lightning.
Never mind they had never owned any kind of business before, or that people had been predicting the death of small bookstores since Barnes & Noble, then Amazon, and then eBooks. They moved to Duluth, depleted their savings to remodel an old liquor store, and opened for business on a summer day in 2017.
It was pandemonium in here. There were TV cameras, and the mayor came, and all of our friends from all over came, and all these people from Duluth came. It was crazy.
And I felt from the beginning that we had a tiger by the tail. You know, I felt like I was not expecting the extent to which we were embraced by the community.
DeBrow says sales have grown about 60% since they opened. They attribute that in part to loyal customers like Chris Johnson, who stopped by to pick up some books for his college-age kids.
One of my great fears is that bookstores will go away. So I feel almost a moral obligation to be in bookstores. It's probably not the norm, but I think it's important to book lovers that such places exist.
Since bottoming out in 2009, the American Booksellers Association says the number of independents has grown by about 35% nationwide. That surprise success intrigued Harvard business professor Ryan Raffaelli, who studied how independent bookstores have managed to be David to Amazon's Goliath.
It's pretty remarkable in terms of what they've been able to do in terms of repositioning themselves.
He's boiled it down to a few things. Community.
Booksellers are deeply embedded in helping to define this notion of why the consumer should shop local.
Many have turned themselves into gathering places for things like author readings and birthday parties. And then there's what Raffaelli calls curation.
If you see a great bookseller at his or her craft, you'll see them ask questions like, what are the last 5 books that you read? And then they'll steer a reader into a genre potentially that is outside, but they say, this is your next great book.
He says that expertise enables booksellers to compete against the algorithms Amazon uses to recommend books. Still, Dan Cullen with the American Booksellers Association says for many stores, it's an uphill climb.
It's a business with razor-thin profits. I don't want to be a Pollyanna because on the one hand, there's been solid success, but on the other hand, it's a challenging road ahead of them as well.
He says many face escalating rents and struggle to pay living wages and benefits. At the Zenith Bookstore in Duluth, sales are brisk, but Bob DeBrow remains realistic.
My wife has this saying, which we repeat a lot, which is, nobody's getting rich, but the bills are getting paid.
Plus, he gets a lot of satisfaction out of it. He says at the end of each day, he still gets goosebumps seeing what he and his wife have created. In Duluth, Minnesota, I'm Dan Crocker for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which the Super Bowl is ruined. Not so much the game itself. That's always kind of hit or miss, right? I'm talking ads, more often than not the buzziest part of the whole thing. Except maybe this year, because we learned today both President Trump and would-be President Mike Bloomberg running for the Democratic nomination have each bought 60 seconds worth of ad time during the game early on, apparently, when more people watch. $10 million apiece is the price tag. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 119 points today, 0.4%. NASDAQ basically flat. The S&P 500 down 9 points. That is 0.2%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Samantha Fields, Joanne Griffith, Ben Heathcote, and Sarah Menendez. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.